Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me on the Vigilance Press podcast. This is James Dossie, owner and publisher, and tonight I have three spectacular guests. We're going to talk about the subject of creating adventures, specifically for Mutants and Masterminds, but if anything else comes up, we'll let you know. But tonight I have with me some luminaries in the field, specifically starting with Christopher McLaughlin, writer of one of my all-time favorite superhero adventures, period. That would be Time of Crisis. Christopher, how are you doing tonight?
You called me spectacular. That's made my whole evening because I was rather feeling like the Ringo of this little gathering. But, you know, you have hopes that I may be George by the time all things are said.
Well, you know, one of the things I really liked about Time of Crisis was that it's kind of a great tour of Freedom City. It's a great way to start. If nobody's ever played in the setting before, you kind of start off by giving the players the chance to save the universe, but not just one universe, multiple universes, and give the players the idea that they kind of, it's a great tour, a place to explore and learn about. So that's what I really...
You're very kind. I mean, good. I mean, wow. 11 years later, people actually appreciate that about it. Because when we first announced the topic, there was this huge little brouhaha on our message boards. Like, how come you're blowing up everything in the first adventure? all I had to say was, because who knows if there's going to be a second.
Second one. Yeah.
You know, I'd buried my share of companies and game systems at that point. You know, I wasn't saving anything for adventure two.
All right, before we forget to introduce everybody else, let me go ahead and segue on to introducing the designer of the rules and author of a few adventures himself, Steve Kenson. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing very well. Thanks, James.
Yeah. Hopefully I don't forget everybody. But so anyway, the topic tonight is we had some funny remarks about it before the show, but you are going to make an admission about game balance in Mutants and Masterminds.
The fact that I joked about the fact that it doesn't really exist at all.
Yep. So more on that.
We'll talk about how the degree to that which that is true.
Yep. And then tonight we also have with us the line developer of Mutants and Masterminds and the guy who is enforcing the rule of no talking about other game systems tonight.
There are no other game systems. There are no other game
systems. John Lighthouser, how are you doing tonight?
Howdy, howdy. I feel like doing the Kermit the Frog.
that would be pretty impressive. But so... basically, game balance is a big question, and we'll be covering that as much as we can in tonight's adventure. But I'm also going to cover the topics of, you know, just getting ideas for games and how to come up with those. And I'll probably steer us towards that in the second half of tonight's podcast. I kind of wanted to get out of the way the idea of game balance and how to do game balance in Mutants and Masterminds, which is a big question that a lot of people new to the system seem to have. And I think it has a lot to do with expectations from other systems. I think Steve was broaching that subject. What do you think, Steve?
Well, I can see how that would be the case. There are certainly other game systems that take a more rigorous approach to game balance than Mutants and Masterminds does. Mutants and Masterminds... generally speaking, the game balance mechanic is primarily found in the power level system. Mm-hmm. So power level is really the regulating leveler that you use as a baseline in terms of setting up your series and making sure that the player characters at least are generally in the same, you know, at the very least they're all playing in the same ballpark, if not necessarily in the same league. And therefore, you can measure the challenges that they're going to face accordingly. To me, the primary thing with game balance is ensuring that the players don't feel cheated, that they feel that on some level the game is fair, challenging perhaps, but still that, you know, they've got a shot, that they're not, you know, simply doomed for the outset, that they have a fighting chance, that if they play well and they get, you know, the dice are with them, and they earn enough hero points, they have a pretty fair chance of success. To me is what game balance is. So there's a certain mathematical element to it, just in the sense that you want to roughly make sure that the numbers balance enough that under most circumstances there's a fair odds of success, and that's really what power level aims to do. But the rest of it is really just game master finesse in terms of providing challenges that are fairly balanced and also give the players an even chance. But beyond that, you know, the whole issue of game balance gets really tricky in terms of superhero games, particularly because superheroes, for one, are often expected to face overwhelming odds. You know, I mean, the very first Mutants and Masterminds adventure, like you cited, you know, the characters are not only in the business of saving the universe, but in fact, the vastness of the omniverse, every universe that ever existed, from destruction by this godlike entity. And, you know, the stakes are hugely high. So that's pretty common in, you know, superhero settings. It's, you know, it's always, you know, the world is threatened with destruction, or you know, the city is threatened or some such. And generally speaking, the villains tend to be pretty powerful. So a certain degree of game balance really comes into being able to finesse the story and being able to encourage the kind of story structure that Mutants and Masterminds is set up to do. And that's basically the sort of the comic book model that in Act One, the heroes encounter the threat in some fashion and are either forced to retreat or defeated or basically realize just how difficult a challenge it is they face.
Right, and somehow that works in comics, which, you know, obviously is a written, scripted, versus playing around the table with all your buddies who have their own particular picadillos around, like, oh, we're getting screwed, and all that sort of good stuff.
Right.
So it works much better in fiction than it does in comics. This whole sort of unfairness. Hey, this guy's way overpowered. We're getting screwed over because you're just trying to kill us all. So that is certainly, there are definite differences between playing a game like the comics and reading a comic.
Yeah.
One of the things that Mutants and Masterminds does a little differently, I think, as far as adventures go and encounters go, is that you introduce things in a much more kind of obvious staged fashion where you kind of have this ramping up. Because, you know, unlike, say, D&D, where you're kind of dealing with dwindling resources through the course of the game, in Mutants and Masterminds, you're building up hero points. The goal is kind of to be, you know, stronger at the end of the game than you started with. So, in that fashion, you know, you're going to be opting for complications and stuff in the first act and embracing those opportunities to get hero points and to face those challenges. So I think that's a little different. I mean, you kind of get that impression in other games where, you know, they'll start you off with the orcs and then work you up to the troll and then have you fight the lich at the end kind of thing. But in Mutants and Masterminds, the game mechanic kind of supports it in a way that's a little different, and I don't think everybody catches that right off the bat when they first pick up the game.
Go ahead, John.
Okay. I was going to say it's you're half right and half wrong on that, because I think so if you want to take a, you know, like D&D as the example, you start off as whatever level your character is going into an adventure, and certainly your hit points and your healing potions and all that stuff goes away over time, but also in theory you are picking up magic items and different, you know, potentially different pieces of knowledge that you can use to defeat the big bad guy at the end.
True.
And you're accruing experience. So it's possible that over the course of an adventure, like, some resources are going away, but some resources are being renewed, or you're getting completely new and different things.
True.
So there is kind of that aspect of that sort of gaming going on at D&D. And then for M&M, I think there's just not the reduced resources. You're only ever increasing resources if you're really husbanding resources. By using the word resources a lot, if you're really husbanding like your hero points. So, if you spend the hero points on a pretty regular basis, you're on a roller coaster ride. But if you're saving them up, then sure, when you fight the big bad guy at the end, you have a bunch and you'll be able to hopefully take them out a little more easily. So it kind of depends on how you play your character, kind of depends on how the GM's running the game. But I actually really like that kind of thought pattern you had going on there, James, regarding resources in general.
Cool. Resources. I just had to say.
Exactly. That's my new tagline. Resources.
So what do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's essentially correct, that the way the hero point structure is set up, it's for the players to accumulate those points over the course of the game so that when the big finale comes, they've got more to play with in terms of making sure that they succeed, you know, when it's really essential that they do so. And that's... I don't think that structure is difficult for game masters to grab onto. I think that sometimes it's difficult for players to embrace. And the hero point structure was intended as a way of kind of rewarding players for putting up with the fact that the game master is going to have to put all of these challenges in their path early on in the adventure. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of their reward for playing along. But some players have a difficulty embracing the idea of, I want my character to not do well in the early part of the adventure because that additional drama gets me something later on in mm-hmm. the adventure. Maybe it's just, you know, the difficulty of delayed gratification in that regard.
I think it's also a lot of other games kind of, and actually Mutants and Masterminds 1 and 2 had a little bit of this, what some people call the death spiral or something, where as you take damage or as you get hurt or as you kind of fail, it becomes kind of a cumulative effect. Mm-hmm. And so people are always trying to stave off that at the beginning, you know, from tactical perspective. But with Mutants and Masterminds 3rd edition, one of the things I really like that you did was you kind of almost made recovering from damage a no-brainer. It's like once you're out of combat, it only takes a few minutes to recover completely.
It's pretty trivial.
Unless the GM decides that, you know, he's going to do something while you're unconscious, in which case, you know, hand out a hero point and tell the players they're screwed. You've been captured or what have you. One of the things that I really like about that is it kind of puts the emphasis on you know, the combat being more about fun than about, you know, all or nothing success or fail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, and generally speaking, you know, superhero combats aren't really about long-term consequences. And we've got the complications mechanic to handle that. We talk about the idea of handling things like, you know, oh, the character is seriously injured in some significant way as a complication that's just ongoing in the story. Because that's pretty much how it shows up in the comics. You know, most of the time, you know, superhero fights, you know, you have the fight and then it's over and everybody, you know, dusts themselves off and that's pretty much that. And, you know, you move on and the damage isn't really relevant anymore.
I remember in very early issues of Spider-Man from the old collections I have, one of the early issues, he had sprained his shoulder or dislocated. I think it was a dislocated mm-hmm. shoulder, but it became a story element because he had to web his arm into a sling and then fight like that, and it caused him complications. But it's not something that you would necessarily expect from a die roll or just a die roll. It's something that a player might go, you know, this would be a great opportunity for some hero points or something, or the GM might decide, you know, I want to make things difficult for, you know, Plastic Man this issue or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
the tricky part about that is that it's largely dictated by the player and the game master's choices at the game table rather than, like you said, rather than by a roll of the dice or by, you know, what the rules have to say.
Yeah, well, M&M is certainly kind of on the continuum of all the games that are out there is really kind of deceptively a high trust game.
Especially in gameplay.
Yeah, especially in gameplay, because you can throw out complications or, you know, just you can tell the player this is going on, like you accidentally, whatever, break apart part of a building and it starts collapsing down and you can either do something to, you know, help out the people who are going to be crushed underneath it, which I assume you will do, and get a complication point or a hero point for it, or you cannot and there will be other consequences and you'll, you know, you be able to continue fighting the villain, but, you know, you're going to have to pay for that, basically. Mm-hmm. And players, again, might feel kind of screwed over by all of that, but I think if everybody sits down with the same kind of mindset of we're all here to tell the story as opposed to we're here to play a tactical game in which we are superheroes and trying to beat the crap out of this person over here who's the bad guy, It's a very different experience. So,
getting back to kind of that tactical aspect, which Mutant Masterminds does have to some degree, we want to keep in mind the idea that you're going to be breaking these adventures up by kind of acts is a good way to do it. It's you're going to be kind of each encounter is kind of ramping up a little bit, but. What would you suggest for a really good, like, the kind of feature challenge for a team of, like, 5 power level 10 characters? What's a good power level range for the villains in that?
Well, it depends on how many villains you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. The primary issue isn't so much power level as it is numbers. In terms of the, and we talk about this some in the Game Master's Guide, in terms of the sheer, you know, economy of what you can accomplish in a round, the primary drawback of single villains, regardless of their power level, is that they're limited in terms of what they can do in
their
any
actions,
given
their number
round,
of actions.
Right. Their number of actions, and we address a number of ways in the Game Master's Guide to deal with that. In the sense that the solo villains might have more area effect powers. They might have more powers that essentially effectively give them more actions, especially powers that are reaction-based, such that it, you know, allows the villain to do certain things when the heroes act, you know, like the classic you know, robot or battle suit villain who has a reaction based, you know, electrical attack. If a hero grabs him, that lets the villain kind of take an action without actually having to use his action to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. But generally speaking, you're looking at basically if the numbers on both sides are roughly equal, you know, plus or minus 2, you want something in the neighborhood of comparable power levels. So, you know, a group of power level 10 heroes, you're going to primarily want power level 10 villains. If you're talking about solo villains, you're probably going to want to bump it up a couple of levels, maybe as many as 3 or 4. So you could easily have a group of 5 power level 10s take on a power level 14 villain if you wanted. That'd be a pretty tough fight, but it's pretty doable.
Yeah, and Steve, you say that, and one of the things that I think is important is to point out to people is that may, as GM, feel like cheating. So if I'm playing, as an example, and this is not a good example, this is a good example. If my players are playing the Teen Titans, And yeah. they are all a collection of, I'll say, when they started in the early 80s in the Wolfman Perez series, like PL8-ish characters, yeah. maybe somewhere a little higher. Mm-hmm. And I put them up against Deathstroke the Terminator.
Right.
He's, I'll say, PL12 when he starts mm-hmm. out. That might feel like cheating because, first off, he might be more powerful, not only than the players, but more powerful than really in my mind, I have a concept for him being.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like really, he should maybe only be a power level 10 or something like that. But you have to ramp him up in order for him to actually come off being as tough as you need him to be in the game, yep. but not be totally overbalanced.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And, you know, it's the thing to keep in mind is that the power level that you set for the series and for the player characters doesn't apply to the villains. Mm-hmm. You know, they can be any power level you want and whatever power level you need them to be in order for them to be effective. You know, the same thing goes in terms of using complications in the villain's favor. You know, essentially that's how the game master spends hero points in Mutants and Masterminds. If the villain needs to succeed on an attack check or needs to succeed on a resistance check and the dice are not with you and you don't want to outright cheat, then, you know, toss the player a hero point and say, sorry, nice try, but it doesn't work. You know, the villain gets that advantage as well. The key thing about it is that the players accumulate something they can use later on as part of that.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting is I did exactly that in an early playtest of MNM3 when I was down in California, and I had a I was using the Big Brain in his first mm-hmm. incarnation, and one of the player characters was playing a speedster who decided to run after one of the bad guys who was escaping, yeah. and because I wanted to let the bad guys get away because it wasn't important in this part of the game for them to actually chase the guys down, find their lair, all that sort of stuff, because I was going to reintroduce the villains again in the next episode, was I just had the Big Brain automatically mind control the speedster, and he went somewhere else, called the players to tell him to meet him there, and they all met up at a Dairy Queen, and he was like, what the hell just happened? And what's funny is, like, they realize, like, oh my god, like, you were just mind controlled and, like, sent over here. And the problem was, all the players from then on thought, I cannot possibly defeat this mentalist character who could be anywhere.
He's too vastly powerful.
Exactly. And instead of thinking, like, oh, that was very unfortunate, you must have just really flubbed your mental save or whatever. No, it was, we can't possibly defeat him. What are we going to do? Which is a drawback to that sort of approach to things, but I also think it was a pretty inexperienced group of players that I was playing with, so mm-hmm. they didn't take it as a, hey, we can just turn around, we can take this guy out. Yeah. Like, you know, it was interesting because it yeah. illustrated a lot of the issues that some players have with kind of that mm-hmm. high trust level of gaming.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, and also some of the degree of just differences in play style. Because, absolutely. You know, a lot of games, especially, you know, the more, you know, D&D, for example, you know, has a bit more of a degree of tactical prudence, you know, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, oftentimes the smart thing to do in a D&D scenario is run and be like, you know, we're way overmatched. You know, the best thing we can do is get out of here and, you know, heal up and, you know, hope to come back and try this again. You know, and maybe live to tell about it. The trick oftentimes when characters are in a superhero game and they're faced with a situation, sometimes tactical retreat is not necessarily a bad thing, but then there are those cases where it's like, well, the fate of the world depends on you. You can't give up.
Yeah,
right.
If you do, it's all over. You know, that sometimes that's where the, you know, the difference comes in, and they have to be like, you know, okay, we need to come up with a way, if we don't have enough hero points, to get some and pull this off.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there are definite differences between the two play styles that, yeah. that are significant.
So, Christopher, how are the dogs doing tonight?
Maggie is flopping around on her back, and it's funny because her wrinkles are all going the wrong direction now. It's pretty funny.
I think I heard her collar in there a second ago.
So. Oh, yeah. She's dying to be a guest.
But,
the attention.
So one of the things that I really like about Mutants and Masterminds, and it doesn't quite show up the same way in all other game systems, but I think the first time I ever saw anything like this was in Torg, actually, is the idea that some characters are kind of feature villains where they get treated the same way as player characters, largely on how they roll dice. But you also have a subset of villain types that we call minions.
Yep.
that don't go by the same rules. They're designed to go down a lot easier so that it becomes more about the numbers. How do you generally work that into play balance? And do you ever use like minions as a genuine threat, or do you mostly consider them like scenery in your games?
They can be genuine threat. You know, it depends a lot on the types of minions you're dealing with. Minions have certain very specific drawbacks and limitations, but the primary advantages they've got, one is sheer numbers. A lot of times there's just a lot of them, mm-hmm. and that can, with team attacks and a lot of other options, give minions some bite in terms of making them effective. The other is the fact that in spite of the name, minions are in no way limited to, guys like shadow agents, who are just, trumped up thugs with guns.
Mm-hmm.
Minions can be pretty much anything. And that includes, big battle robots or summoned demons from the netherworld or any of these other things that are like, power level 8 or more. And capable, apart from their minion status, of dishing out and taking as much damage as the player characters can. So I've done scenarios with minion types who are pretty tough, apart from the fact that one successful hit will take them down. The trick is getting a successful hit sometimes.
And number 21.
Yeah. The fact that the minions can dish out a fair amount of damage in the meanwhile. So,
And there's also in M&M something that I find really interesting. And I touched on this a little bit in the Iron Age book for second edition, that I think we haven't used very often or even at all, is to use a PL10 villain as a minion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you need to, and actually, I think we may have done that in the Emerald City Knights adventure at some point, maybe in part three, where we say if you want to have a whole bunch of villains around, just treat them as minions.
Yeah, actually, I've done that in some of my own games. I think we talk about that in the end of Emerald City Knights, where we've got that just like army of villains.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you're doing this scenario, and it's actually great for these kind of scenarios, where you've got, just like this ton of bad guys. I've done scenarios for M&M where, the classic, mind-controlling villain takes over the world, mm-hmm. Scenario. But the big catch being that pretty much everybody except the big mind-controlling villain is now a minion. So it's like, well, yeah, he can send the Freedom League after you because he controls them, but they're all minions now. So you can actually take them out relatively easy comparatively. It's like that big fight at the end of season one of Young Justice, where they go up against the mind-controlled Justice League, and Kid Flash says, if these guys weren't mind-controlled, we wouldn't have had a prayer. It's because, they're all minions now. You can take them all out easy.
Right.
One of the things I've done,
even in a crowd scene, you can do that.
Absolutely.
Just like an escape from prison, and it's like, okay, normally these characters that the heroes are knocking out might be the focus of a long-term adventure, right. At least a session or two. But since they're all in a group and all trying to break out of prison, all of a sudden they turn into wusses, and you can just punch them once and they fall down. Yep. And I think that's a perfectly valid use of the minion rules, and actually. gives the players a really cool feeling that they are super powerful for whatever reason, right?
One, like, one of the things I like to use that in that same vein, not just for crowd scenes, but I've often introduced what I will assume, you know, will be a lieutenant of like my big bad as like a campaign element early on, mm-hmm. and I'll have the lieutenant treated as a normal character when they first meet him, but you know, the next few times that he shows up, or if he shows up as part of a group of villains, you know, in a crowd scene, or even just solo, you know, as kind of a more minor part of the story, as the heroes have got a better idea of, you know, the bigger threat, you know, I start treating him as a minion where, you know, I just say, you know, if he takes damage, he's out of the fight kind of thing. And, you know, I don't have to change his numbers at all. I don't have to do any editing to the character. I just change the way I handle his resistance checks and his roles.
Yep.
Yeah, no, I totally think that's a fair thing to do. I actually almost think there needs to be a step between regular character and minion, but I haven't figured that out yet, so.
Yeah. Yeah, you could easily do some kind of a, you know, lieutenant type.
Yeah, where he takes two hits or something.
Right. You know, something along those lines.
That's possible.
Yeah, I really like that idea.
Yeah, that and as I was saying before, I think the first time I ever saw that was in Torg, where they had the same kind of thing. I don't remember what they called it there, but
they had the ords.
Yeah. Well, they had two kinds of damage tracks, one right. for ordinaries and one for possibility rated characters.
Yep.
So I always you know, as soon as I saw that in the Mutants and Masterminds rules, I was like, oh yay, I know that, I know how to do this. So that made it really easy for me to kind of absorb the rest of the rules, because I started thinking in terms almost of like a Torg campaign, the same way I'd use, you know, threats and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the possibilities were also very similar to Hero Points, so it was kind of, you know, at home in this system almost immediately. But one other kind of encounter, aside from combat encounters, there's another kind of encounter that I like to use a lot. And that's skill challenges, where people are making skill checks. And I try to set my challenges up to allow as many of the players as possible to participate. But sometimes it's like, okay, while these guys are defusing a bomb, you guys have to fight some robots, you know.
Yep.
Break it up, you know, if you need to. Yep. But what do you guys usually pick as a good target difficulty number for, like, a skill challenge? I mean, do you usually base it on the power level of the game, or do you specifically watch the player character's skill ranks?
I tend to look at the player character's skill bonuses because, you know, I usually know them, you know, in advance, so I tend to tailor the challenge to what I know that they can do. And it may not necessarily be tailored towards, you know, what they can do well. Sometimes the challenges are aimed at things that, you know, are more of their mid-range skills. Sometimes it's a great opportunity to, you know, let the players show off what their characters are good at. But, you know, and it's really just aiming. Again, you're really looking for something that lets the players not feel like they're being cheated, and that they have a fair shot at things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really just looking at something that gives them an opportunity to accumulate enough successes before their time runs out. And that's just balancing the difficulty against the chances of failure, really.
Yeah.
Usually I try to give them a better than, you know, at least slightly better than 50-50 shot at success time.
On the flip side of that is also the the possibility that it will be too much of a cakewalk, and you feel like you're just treading water to get to the next thing, where it's like, because you want to make it a challenge, but you don't want to make it so much of a challenge that everything is just screwed and everybody goes home unhappy because they failed a single die roll.
Yeah.
So there, it is definitely a fine line, but this is where sort of the behind the screens GM fiat slash fudging comes into play, where you have to be conscious of walking that line and be able to adjust or ignore the difficulties as you're going along. And if somebody blows a number, well, actually, it turns out you didn't have to make that many successes, and I'm just going to ignore that one and go on to the next role, and hey, you succeed. But you can't communicate that information. That's the important thing mm-hmm. to the players, right? They need to feel like it's a seamless skill challenge from the beginning to end, and you are not really playing in their favor.
Yeah.
And when they overcome it, they feel like they've actually overcome something.
Right. Right, and the trick is to not make it, you know, mechanically. Skill challenges, unfortunately, can be a touch dull, in the sense that they're essentially just a series of die rolls,
mm-hmm.
And if you treat them as just okay, you have to roll, you know, 5 skill checks, and you need to succeed on at least 3 of them. You know, if you handle it very mechanically, they can be very dry.
Mm-hmm.
So the real trick with challenges is to make them narratively interesting by really dressing them up and giving them some dramatic flair and really describing to the players enough so that they feel like there's some peril involved in it, whether it's just ramping up the danger that they're facing as the challenge is ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
Or adding new setbacks to it, which is a great opportunity to toss the players some hero points if they need them, move things along and also provide some additional tension. But something that adds and encourages, hopefully, the players to embellish on their own descriptions of what it is their characters are doing rather than, okay, I just make my, you know, sleight of hand check.
One of the things that I found helped me kind of created a safety net for the heroes. I like the idea of basically saying you need to get 5 successes versus 3 failures, you know, before you get 3 failures or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, giving, you know, a number of failure opportunities for them to make, you know, a roll rather than say, okay, you have 3 turns to do this. The problem with something like that, you know, where you might try to work it out on some sort of time frame like a time bomb. Mm-hmm. You know, is that, you know, in 3 turns something might come up that you didn't plan on and creates an unwinnable situation or something.
Right.
But, you know, if you've got the situation set up where it's number of successes versus failures, you have that kind of player-driven timeline. And you can actually, you know, as a GM, make the decision, well, if they hit this number of failures, I'm going to say, you know, instead of, you don't want to tell the players how many they have one way or another. Mm-hmm. Another option is to quite simply, you know, when they blow a roll or something, hit them with a complication, like, you know, it's like, okay, you know, a second timer just went off, you know, ramp up
right.
the tension
right.
Without necessarily letting them know that you're kind of creating actually an umbrella to give them that room to be successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's kind of funny because sometimes I've discovered that doing one of these kind of skill challenges in the middle of a sequence in the game, you know, it's kind of a good bridging moment where, you know, the players have an encounter and then, you know, they have the opportunity to try and, you know, capture the bad guy. And then he kind of distracts them with, you know, some sort of doomsday device
mm-hmm.
and, you know, he gets his getaway. But you sometimes think of this as just kind of a throwaway scene, but if you really put a lot of effort into making the players feel like big damn heroes for stopping the bomb or saving the people, you have the opportunity to kind of make them feel like they succeeded despite the fact that the bad guy got away. And I think that's an important element there too.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And the funny thing is about challenges is I find that they really do encourage teamwork. Even more so than a lot of combat encounters do.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, combat encounters, players have a tendency to get very focused on what their character is going to do next.
Mm-hmm.
But in challenges, maybe it's just because they're all focused on this particular challenge, they get very good all of a sudden at helping each other out. And,
right.
you know, doing team checks and doing support
right.
checks to help out the guy who's going to make the big check to advance things along, those
mm-hmm.
kind of things. And all of a sudden, it's about how can we work together to solve this problem.
Right.
So.
And that's, to me, the big fun of the superhero genre, too, is you generally have this camaraderie that becomes very important as opposed to a game where each character has a very simple static role, you know, your personality is as much a part of why you work together as your skill set. So, I think that kind of scene where you're able to bring people together on that level gives them a chance to role play at the same time as they're, you know, doing team checks and stuff. So it becomes a little less tactical on that line, you know, on that angle of thinking, and more about the role play. It's like, well, I need to be able to help them to do this. What's a good excuse for my character, you know, the brick, to be able to help them defuse a bomb, you know?
Right.
And I really like that because it kind of gets them into that creative mindset. So that's kind of is, I mean, did you guys want to cover any other aspects of the technical aspects of adventure creation, or shall we move on to the,
Well, the only other, speaking of the creative mindset, the only other thing about game balance, and this is where you get into the tricky element of game balance, is especially in a superhero game like Mutants and Masterminds, there's always the potential for that character who just happens to have the right ability, or the player who just happens to have that right brilliant idea, that just utterly detonates the game balance of your encounter.
Yes.
Because the player's character has that right power that is just like, oh, well, yeah, I just phased through the wall. Yeah. Oh, I forgot you could do that. Crap.
Right.
You know, or what have you. You know, whatever the ability may be. There's so many superpowers. And with the flexibility of the power stunt system, it doesn't take much for a clever player to come up with, you know, an unusual application of a character's powers that can totally derail an encounter if you're not handling it carefully. And some of that is really just a matter of again, it's game master finesse of being able to say, you know, really measure and say, you know, okay, does this really, you know, is it a big deal if I just say, okay, you're right, you win. Or do I have to come up with some lesser, you know, degree of, well, yes, that really does help a lot, but, and, you know, here's a hero point, by the way, sort of a thing, and, you know, kind of working that out.
Yeah, one of the things that I've actually had my fair share of derailing my GM's plot lines in the past. Most often with magic, because magic as a descriptor is very flexible, and I remember one guy had a campaign where his whole idea for the campaign was he was going to destroy the game setting and send us on this kind of Sliders-esque storyline where we were jumping from universe to universe finding a new place. But in the first campaign, I found an arguable way that my player could basically save the world, which, you know, basically brings his entire campaign concept to a screeching halt. Yep. And it's like, you know, you have as a GM kind of this opportunity to go, well, do I let them do this or do I not? And, you know, how much can you say no to before the players just start feeling like, you know, you're cheating against them or you're not letting them
use
their creativity.
Exactly, because you want to encourage the players to be creative. And, you know, in my experience, you never present the players with a situation you don't want them to be able to affect. You know, if you want to start your campaign off as, you know, the characters are, you know, randomly hopping from universe to universe, then you're best off to open the first game with having survived the destruction of your home universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not even... Because if you play it out, then that's exactly what's going to happen, is some player is going to say, well, we can save the universe.
Right. And that's probably their motivation, right? Like, that's
right. Of course it is. They're superheroes.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's never leave it up to chance, something that you absolutely want to have happen.
So I'm totally stealing this idea about hopping from universe to universe in an adventure.
It'll never work.
Well, you know, first you have to blow up the universe, and if the players don't let you do that, you know, you got to kind of skip to that scene, right?
Yeah. I shall note, by the way, that Professor McLaughlin handled that in the proper way in Time of Crisis, where the destruction of the universe happens off stage. And all the heroes know about it is when the universe disappears.
Yeah.
And they're like, what happened?
That was great, by the way. It was one of these modes because you set it up so that the players get a moment of victory beforehand. I mean, assuming that they're able to handle the villains that you offered up at the beginning there. But it's like, you know, that kind of rhythm of it, you know, you have the characters doing something that's very in genre for the heroes to start off, you know, basically tackling a group of kind of wannabe villains, very, or very, almost very, has-beens, you know?
The very meat and potatoes villains that are the Thieves Guild.
Yeah. And then, you know, you pull the master switch where all of a sudden the lights go out and the real story begins. And that's a great way to kick off any session, really, is to kind of start players off, you know, kicking some butt and then, you know, hitting them with a surprise threat.
Mm-hmm.
So actually, that bridges us into the actual storytelling aspect of game design, I think, which is something that a lot of players who are used to running kind of bottled adventures, which are, you know, include maps and storylines and very fleshed out NPCs. Not a lot of people are used to sitting down and kind of creating something on the fly, but some of us who've been doing this for a long time, it comes secondhand, and it's, you know, you have to ask hard questions in order to get these answers. And these hard questions sound so easy, but it's like, where do you get your ideas kind of thing? And I think I'll start with Christopher McLaughlin, because his ideas are so crazy and kooky that I have to know, where do you get your ideas?
Thank you. Well, it's one of the blessings of growing up in rural Virginia that you either retreat into your own imagination or you retreat into utter madness.
Which was maybe you?
Would argue is the same thing.
Maybe I did a bit of both. I don't really know. But I just became fascinated with stories, especially ones that had absolutely nothing to do with the mundanity of the life around me. And I guess at an early age, I just started breaking down stories. You know, what are these elements that work here? What is it? Why is this scene so powerful? Why does this matter? And, you know, over the time, I've just devoured so much media because, you know, film and gaming are my two great media loves. And, you know, just seeing that, you know, hey, you know, after a while, you know, there's so much in my head that they start to crowd around and they start to mix and match. Like we've been talking about Time of Crisis all evening. And it is my love letter to the great summertime JLA-JSA crossovers that Julie Schwartz orchestrated for so many years. But that chapter one just simply comes from my fascination. I'd gone through this period watching like every Vegas movie I could find. I had like Ocean's 11, Casino, and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas on like continuous loop. So to me, it's sort of about my fascination with small time hustlers and people that, you know, actually will wander into a casino telling themselves, yeah, I'm going to get rich. I'm so not going to blow Junior's college fund. So, you know, in the midst of this very, very, very childlike summertime innocence thing, you know, there's sort of that air of desperation that you get from any good Vegas movie there, at least in chapter one. It's not overwhelming, but that's where it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just to me, it's just the ability to mix and match different elements. Mm-hmm. And things like that. And I think as long as you're devouring good media and as long as you have the lack of ego to accept that there really are only seven plots, right? And, you know, just right. Because you're drawing your inspiration from somewhere else, there is absolutely no reason to be ashamed of that whatsoever. It's just really, I mean, I would certainly not brag about my abilities or call myself good or even great most days. But, you know, I'm at heart, I'm doing what every other creative person is doing. We're just jiggling around those same seven plots and just trying to come up with an all new combination that maybe you haven't seen too many times before.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say too, that there is a terrific, because the Rogues Gallery, the Thieves Guild is, you know, a great homage to Flash's Rogues Gallery. They have the same sort of charming kind of blue collar quality to their villainy. That, you know, you always get the impression that most of, you know, with the exception of, you know, the guys who are putting on airs like Abracadabra, that, you know, most of Flash's bad guys were like these working stiffs, you know, who just, you know, fell into super villainy as, you know, a way to make a few bucks. You know, and so the Thieves Guild comes off much the same way, in the sense that they're working supervillains. You know, they're just in it for the money. You know, forget this grandiose, you know, scheming and all of this. They're just, you know, they want to rob a casino.
They're grinding it out.
You know? And that's just really as far as their ambition goes. And you know, that just makes really – it makes for a great, you know, opening to that adventure, because it is so straightforward as far as that goes. Mm-hmm. It's like bad guys with sacks with dollar bills on them.
Yep.
You know? You know, and, you know, here you are, you know, to haul them off to jail. You know, that's all there is to it.
You know, when I had to do the expanded write-up for them for Freedom's Most Wanted, it suddenly occurred to me that, like, they're really not that good of supervillains, but what a reality show this team would make. Yeah.
Because
they all just kind of barely tolerate each other, and I'm thinking, you know, that, yeah, there you go. I see what you're saying there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you even see that in the modern development of Flash's Rogues Gallery. It's like they're a union. You know, they're like unionized supervillains. You know, they all hang out in the same bar together. You know, they all kind of look out for each other.
They really took that to the next level in that one Justice League episode, where it starts off literally with the Flash's Rogues Gallery sitting around beers in a bar, complaining, you know, about the almost got him.
If I don't get a heist soon, the wife is going to kill me.
Oh yeah,
I have to drink. I have to drink milk because of my ulcer.
My ulcers are acting up. You know. So, I mean, there's a lot to be said for having some kind of blue collar supervillains in your game, to, you know, handle the grunt work of, you know, the honest supervillainy.
So,
and thus Foe was born.
Yes, indeed.
So what would be the difference, you know, your difference in approach? I guess I'll direct this at Christopher again, because he's been playing with the dog all the time, and I want to distract him from the dog. So what would be your major difference in approaching writing an adventure when you actually are writing for your own players, as opposed to writing something for publication where you don't know who's going to play it?
Well, at least for me, when I'm writing for my players, I was always blessed with very, very, very great players who were always very, very, very open and often fairly unsubtle about what they wanted. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was just a question of making sure that they all went home happy, that something that I know that they went for, that they were looking to get out of this game, this campaign, characters happened pretty much every night, if I could possibly manage to pull that off.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're writing for a mass audience, you lose that intimacy, and then you just have to feel a lot more confidence in your core idea. You have to believe that you've got something that's going to work for the vast majority of people that are going to pick this up. And a lot of times, really, you know, if you're writing for a mass audience, you know, you have to put your head down and just trust your own ego and your own whatever talent you have, that, you know, this idea really is as good as you think it is. Now, I mean, I've not only been blessed with great players, I've been blessed by people who aren't afraid to go, you know, that sucks. That's really awful. That's really terrible. Now, granted, most of them are sweeter about that, but, you know, just, you know, the, you know, having somebody there to kind of keep me honest and maybe poke me into doing a little better every now and again, that's certainly been very, very, very valuable.
Oh yeah, for any artist, a good critique is invaluable. So for me, when I approach an adventure, I do most of my adventure writing for my players. And the joy of that is that, again, as you say, they've done a lot of the work for me, in that they kind of tell me by the characters they've created and the complications that they've written into the character, what they want to do and what they want to encounter. Because, you know, they've written in, like, for our Beacon City game, Lynn has written in, you know, some rivals in the library. So, you know, my first adventure is going to be a little generic, because I'm going to be, you know, that was kind of, you know, our attempt to allow the characters to kind of find their voice. But now that I've got the players kind of moving forward, it's a question of, okay, well, how do I make each character important through the course of the game? And a lot of the time I find that looking at these characters' backgrounds and what their motivations are and what drives them and everything, and kind of sprinkling that into a storyline and just kind of putting them down in an order, I've done 90% of the work, and oftentimes all I need to do is come up with a thematically matched supervillain and an evil scheme to hatch, and I'm done. So for me, that part of the adventure creation is very easy, but I think a lot of people don't take advantage of their players in that way. I don't know. You know, as far as other kinds of approaches, Steve, do you have like a different kind of approach when you're dealing with your players that you might not use when you're writing something for mass audience? Or,
well, you know, when it comes to designing adventures for my game group that I've been, you know, gaming with for, you know, decades now, you know, it's much easier in the sense that I have a very strong sense of what my players like, what their predilections are, what they are likely to enjoy in a game, things they're likely to do. You know, I mean, we joke, you know, semi-seriously about the fact that I could write an adventure for a new game system that included creating all of their characters for them, and they'd be perfectly happy with what I gave them because I know their preferences well enough to say, oh, yeah, this is what you'd play in this game anyway. you know, so, I mean, I can get away with a good deal more of, you know, putting things together on the fly when it comes to running a game for my home group, just because I know them well enough to say, you know, if this scenario came up, this is pretty much what it would have, how it would play out. So I have a pretty fair sense of just running it from notes and things like that. When you're writing an adventure for publication, the trick is really to provide both a strong through line, a strong central plot, but also a lot of options, a lot of ways and different sort of directions that the players and their characters can connect to that plot, so that you can fit in as many different possibilities as you can, because you never know what kind of characters are going to be, you know, participating in the adventure. So that's the real trick of it. In my experience, superhero adventures are largely soap operas anyway. So, you know, a lot of it really is once the process of developing the characters' personal lives and their backgrounds and their likes and dislikes and letting those things start to sort of play themselves out.
Okay. John, did you have anything to add, or shall I jump into some of these questions that people submitted here?
I always have stuff to add.
Okay.
No, I think it's important to reiterate what Christopher said earlier, which is that there's only so many plots that exist in the world, and we just use them and reuse them and reuse them. And I think one of the reasons why GMs, and this is certainly the case with me, so maybe I'm just projecting, but I think one of the problems that GMs have with running games, whether it be a superhero game or anything else, is that they feel like they have done all of this before, and they're just, they're just whitewashing it, you know? And I think it's healthier not to feel that way, or healthier to ignore that feeling and just be like, no, I'm going to come up with something. And the fun is not in the, especially in a role-playing game, the fun is not in the coming up with what the players are going to encounter. Mm-hmm. The fun is realizing what they do at the table and how they change the encounter by interacting with it, and sort of the fun and adventure that comes out of that.
Yeah, all the best moments in RPGs are never planned.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right. Exactly. And you could never plan them, right? Like, no. The things that are fun are things that you would never even think were going to happen during the game. So I think it's important for GMs to kind of get the, oh god, another kidnapping, or oh, another bank right. robbery. Like, it's really how the players deal with it, and then the crazy things that you and they come up with during an encounter. I had a game a few years ago. I was running for my Wednesday night crew, and one of the characters, this was a Golden Age setting M&M game, and one of the characters was playing this really pretty straightforward female powerhouse who had been turned into metal. Mm-hmm. So she was like a Colossus type or whatever. I mean, she was pretty straightforward. But the way she got her powers was she was dropped into this vat of molten metal. And so she could actually become incredibly hot, too. And so during this, and it was a straightforward bank robbery, during this bank robbery with a villain named Tangler and a bunch of his normal thug followers, minions, one of the minions like pulls off his mask and is like, oh, my God. Like, you have to help me. And it was the female, I don't remember her name, but the female powerhouse's brother who had always been a troublemaker. And it was like, oh, God. So now she had to try and get him out of the thing. Like, I didn't know what she was going to do. She sets the bank on fire.
That's awesome.
And like, she just meant to do it as a distraction, awesome. But it was pretty entertaining. Like, yep. It was a bank robbery, and it turned out being actually really interesting as this very cloddy powerhouse had to try and sneak her brother out so he wouldn't get arrested. And it was, anything can be really fun if things go the way you.
There's a saying that says good stories come from really bad decisions.
Don't be optimal.
Yeah, well, that's the thing is again, sometimes in from the game perspective, players have a tendency to try and play it safe. They look for the most optimal solution to a situation, and sometimes it's a matter of finding ways to encourage them to think like their characters. And, be like, all of us who just do stupid, emotionally driven things from time to time. Yeah. And sometimes if it's not a matter of getting the player characters to make a bad decision, it's like, the example John gives of having somebody they care about do it. And then now they're in the position of having to fix it. A lot of the interesting stories are the ones that come from, well, somebody did something dumb and now we got to deal with it.
Well, I think that's a great, callback to how the comic books work too. You get to see that all the time where, it's like somebody makes a bad decision by like not telling somebody something that would just clear everything up.
Right.
And you kind of sit there wanting to shake the character, but it keeps you turning the pages. So
sure. Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to jump into some of the questions that some folks on the Atomic Think Tank and other locations have asked us when I let them know about this podcast coming up. One thing that Jameson asked, which is a pretty good talking point, I think, is how do you design a campaign or an adventure to fit into a campaign over a long term? How do you kind of design towards an end game that takes multiple adventures to get to?
Chris, you want to talk?
I don't know if I have an answer. This is John. Sorry, I'm butting in on whatever you're going to say. I don't know if I have a good answer for that because I'm really good at the first session and good at a lot of the follow-up sessions, and I rarely, if ever, have an endpoint in mind in my campaigns. I tend, and I think that's my training from how I gamed when I was in college, which was like a nonstop orgy of gaming every weekend. our games literally went on for years and years and years and years and years and had multiple different GMs. So I am not an excellent end game GM. Mm-hmm. So hopefully one of the others has more to say. And I think Steve was going to say, Chris, do you have any suggestions?
Well, mildly spoilery stuff for Time of Vengeance, if you somehow haven't managed to play it in the last 7 years.
And if so, shame on you.
Yeah. So thank you. But for me, it's just that classic writer thing of start with your ending. Because I had the ending of Time of Vengeance before I had anything else. It's just I had this villain, and they probably have to meet their demise at the end, and I wanted that to mean something. I didn't want this to be villain dead, start the parade, for a change.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all about how is it that I can come up with a satisfying superhero adventure and then still build this character up to where their sacrifice means something. I mean, the end of their life actually has an impact on the players. And it was sort of complicated by the fact that, you know, just for reasons of balance and whatnot else, you can't really have a direct interaction to them. And that's where I got the idea for doing the Citizen Kane thing, where you meet all these people, these other people that have interacted with your main character. So I think if Time of Vengeance goes well for a group, you know, you do get the sense of the loss and tragedy that's been in their lives. And everything else in there, the supervillain fights, the bizarre digressions into Foghat concerts, it all sooner or later comes back to this central purpose of letting you know what a really, really terrible life this person has made for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just, you know, once you have that last scene in your head and you can connect everything back to that, it will all hopefully hold together.
Well, and so is the question that's being asked specifically, like, about campaign enders, or is this about adventure endings?
Well, I think for me, the question specifically was how do you work it into, you know, how do you work adventures into a campaign over longer term and design towards an end game. But I think what Christopher says is perfectly in line. To me, you know, if you look at like a good TV story arc, mm-hmm. you know, like I'll show my age here and talk about Babylon 5, which is probably too old for any of the kids listening to have seen.
I'm sad now.
But no, seriously, Babylon 5 was designed around the idea of multiple story arcs that connected to a larger story, and each episode, you know, having a satisfying ending. You know, for the most part, there were a couple of two-parters, but the basic premise was that you would have a complete episode that would have a story, beginning, middle, and an end, but it would, you know, drop breadcrumbs that when you stitch them all together became a larger story, and those larger stories would be called like arc episodes by the writers. And mm-hmm. when you tackle a campaign, and this is something that Jack and I have been talking about a lot lately, there's a lot of stuff you want to do to enable the players to kind of understand what's going on and to take in the information that's going to make the ending of that campaign satisfying, if you are shooting for a big ender. And like what Christopher said, if you have the ending in mind, you know, where hopefully the ending is all about the heroes saving the day, and then you kind of have this opposition in mind where, okay, well, this is what I want them to be defeating. And then you make sure that the story supports that ending every step of the way and just kind of break it down into sizable, manageable chunks. It kind of starts writing itself if you've got that idea. At least for me, because everything for me is about organizing and outlining stuff and just kind of breaking it down into the appropriate, like, beats, you know, kind of almost like a rhythm.
Yeah, and I think I'm on maybe the opposite end of that spectrum from you, because mm-hmm. I tend to, like, I might have an idea of what I want to do over the course of a game mm-hmm. or a longer term, like a series, but I don't necessarily have it all planned out, because I think that takes away from some of the spontaneity and like the cool ideas mm-hmm. I would never think of just by myself in a room.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I tend to just kind of go with it, do what the players, you know, what you were saying before, what the characters are telling me they want in the game, or what the players are mm-hmm. saying
yeah.
by their characters, what they want in the game. And then I cheat and I tie it all together later on if sure. I need to have a big,
yeah.
Hey, this was all part of my plan the whole time kind of thing.
Yeah. Honestly, couldn't we just answer all the questions tonight with cheat?
Yeah,
we could.
You know,
well, that would make it a lot shorter podcast.
I think the practical information is what people are looking for. But so, and really, I don't want to say either way is wrong, right? And mm-hmm. there's other
absolutely.
Ways you can do it. I mean, if you are a planner, plan out your game, like figure out what you want to do, figure out what you want the characters to mm-hmm. end up being like.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're, you know, a little more like me or way more like me, just run your game. And then if it becomes important that you have to try and have an overarching plot in the background. Figure out a way. I mean, it's like tarot. Figure out what the meaning is behind all the pieces that are on the board and tie it all together.
Yeah.
I do have – okay, go ahead, Steve. Sorry.
I was going to say the thing with the long-term arc is that it's – there's a potential payoff in it, but it's also a big gamble.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that you have to invest a lot of time and effort, you know, in terms of getting the characters there, you know, up to that ending you have in mind, and there's a lot that can go wrong along the way, mm-hmm. And it can be very difficult. It takes a lot of finesse to pull that off without it getting railroady. And mm-hmm. it seeming like we're going to come to this ending no matter what we do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Where sooner or later it's really hard to run, especially a long campaign. And it depends. A short arc is easy, relatively speaking.
True.
But the longer the arc gets, the more just a slight deviation, can really just throw everything off. And so that gets harder. And I find some agreement with John in the sense that I think that campaigns tend to be more organic in how they develop. When I was first running superhero games, I was like just madly scavenging from everywhere. I would take, villains and I would run a modified version of a Villains and Vigilantes adventure 1 week, and then it would be something I swiped out of a Marvel Superheroes book the next week, and all of it just stitched together and mixed and matched with different stuff from my own creation, from characters from different source books, and it all gelled at the game table, and especially in retrospect as the games paid themselves out and the characters established more history, it started to look more like a complete whole rather than just a bunch of random things that I had thrown together.
Yeah.
But I didn't start out with a grand scheme beyond, hey, let's play superheroes.
One of the kinds of adventures that I can't run anymore because we're all grown-ups and people can't stay up until 3 a.m. gaming on a Sunday is that there was back in the old high school days or college days when we would just say, nobody's doing anything tomorrow, let's just keep going. And
yes, the marathon game session.
Yeah, the game session that kind of starts and you expect it to be over in 6 hours, and before you know it, you've been gaming for like 13 hours straight. And, you've gone way beyond any specific concept you had for a story, and you're just kind of like riffing off what the players are doing and just going, well, they've decided to go to another universe. Well, let me grab some random characters from this book over here and decide, what the universe they're going through, and it just put something completely new and unexpected together, and it's very organic and very fun. And a lot of those wind up being some of the most memorable experiences mm-hmm. because you were discovering it as much as they were, and mm-hmm. and it's a lot of fun for a GM if you can let go and just roll with it. That sense of discovery comes along with you, as opposed to, one of my friends is very much a planner, and I think he spends so much time planning that when anything goes a way he doesn't expect, he's disappointed on some level, and he's also unable to kind of roll with it.
Yeah.
But if you just give yourself that opportunity every now and then, just, I'm just going to run whatever comes up off the top of my head, and let's just see what the players take it.
Yeah.
That can be fun.
That's the tough part about the arc based story is mm-hmm. that you fall in love with a particular you become the writer of the story, mm-hmm. and you fall in love with a particular scene and are just like, oh, I can't wait till this amazing scene that I have in my head gets played out. And you're absolutely guaranteed that your players, who are not clued in on this, are going to completely wreck your beautiful vision.
Yeah.
And you're just going to feel nothing.
They phase through the wall and say, we ignore right. this encounter. Yeah, exactly.
Right. You know, and that you're going to feel nothing but disappointment about it, because it's like, oh, you know, my beautiful masterpiece. You know, but like you said, instead, if you're open to the possibilities and you're not attached to, you know, this has to go this way, then sometimes some really amazing stuff can happen. And, yeah. you know, you can get this spontaneous moment out of it.
I think yeah. something – this has actually been helping me and Jack get along, because Jack, if you were to say he had any problems, Jack Norris has an overabundance of ideas, and he's really good at going, hey, I got this really idea, you know, this idea to make this project, like, you know, three times bigger. And I'm like, yeah, but we don't want to do that, you know. So, you know, it's like same approach, you know, we take to that as we take to, you know, I take to gaming. Whereas if something doesn't work out for a given project or a given adventure, in this case, we yeah. save it, you know, you save it for later, and there will always be another opportunity to use it. There will always
be another... reuse it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. There's always the, you know, if you wait long enough, your players are not going to notice kind of
yeah.
thing. Depending, or even if you have a whole new group of players, there are certain games like Time of Crisis, which I usually use to kick off, yep. you know, and introduce people to the Freedom City setting if I'm going to run a series in that, just because it kind of puts everybody in the right mindset for the setting and all that. So having these kind of things in your pocket, and of course there's always time travel. If you want to revisit a scene that was really cool, but yep. do something different, you can always have your characters time travel. Like they've done that in a couple of Star Trek episodes where, you know, they had to go back in time and run in a parallel adventure without disturbing the other adventure, but they kind of got to see those things happening again.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a fun approach that you can do in superhero games, because mm-hmm. you have that time travel fantasy thing going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you have an encounter in mind, you have some idea of what happens if the players solve it, some idea of mind of what's going to happen if they lose it, you basically have your bases covered. You have something in mind in case, you know, you're longtime players or you are together and something magical doesn't happen.
Right. Right.
You know,
as is sometimes the case.
You know, and I've been as guilty as anybody of like writing down a 2-line plot description and then writing down, and then my players will be brilliant and figure out how this ends.
Yep.
But really, if that's really your job is to have something in your mind on paper for, you know, if lightning mm-hmm. doesn't strike that particular
right.
night.
Right. It doesn't matter if your players don't know that you abandoned it in the middle of Act One, you know, but at least you had that concept, you know, mm-hmm. ready, you know, in case you needed it.
Yeah. I mean, if your players write something brilliant, more brilliant than what you came up with, great, your work is done. But you know, you're planning is, well, what if this goes to hell? Yeah.
And in fact, that's one thing that good GMs, especially in a superhero game, should always plan for. And we again talk about that in Game Master's Guide, is the inevitable, so what if the villain wins?
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to set up really high stakes, you have to at some point, you know, say, you know, to what degree are we working without a net here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to what degree do I have to have, have consequences in order for my players not to feel cheated?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
if they for some reason fail to stop the doomsday device, do I have to blow the world up?
Yeah,
you know,
that's true. That's true.
Because again, unlike a nice scripted comic book where we can predetermine the ending. Even if there are some twists in terms of getting there, you know, you never know that things happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we hit that point in Time of Crisis, and I actually went back and reread what I wrote recently, and I cracked myself up how belligerent I am at the end, because it's like, what if the players screw it up? Well, then everybody dies. Good luck with that ending. And then, you know, I blow that off in two sentences and then go off, well, here's how you can save the players for themselves and maybe, just maybe, deliver a slightly more satisfying ending.
It was kind of funny. Yes, I remember that.
Thank you.
But one of the things I tend to do, and actually this I'm going to try and steer us back into some of these questions here, because that was a good sidebar. But one of the things I try to do for a long-term campaign and kind of go towards an end game is I'll think of, you know, I'll focus more on the opposition and the opposition's goals than I will on specific scenes. You know, for example, if I have a villain whose goal is to, you know, conquer the Earth, but I want to introduce him on a smaller scale, you know, I kind of have his idea of what his ideas of the plans are and you know, how the players are going to stumble across his plans. And then I just see what the players do about it. And, you know, I have him, you know, if he goes to jail, he might escape and come back and, you know, make new friends to try and beat up the players. And you know, maybe based on the kind of character, maybe he'll wind up being a Joker type character who's more about, you know, who's defined by his interaction with the players. Or maybe he's more of like a Doctor Doom type character where the players kind of, you know, when they hear about who's involved, they know what the scale is going to be, you know, and mm-hmm. you have these kind of toolkit characters that you can steal from comics and just kind of decide, well, this is what this guy would do and this is why he would do it, and then just let the players in on what's going on and kind of let them, you know, figure out how the story goes from there. It's pretty much, you know, a very simple approach, but it works really well for me.
Yeah, it is very effective.
But going on to the, let's see, Insomnia gave us some good talking points here. He's from the Atomic Think Tank. And he started off with a point that Steve has made in a couple of, you know, interviews. I don't remember if you've spoken on one of my interviews, but I remember you've said that superheroes are very reactive instead of proactive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's for example, in a lot of like D&D sessions, you kind of start off with the characters are in a bar and you know, somebody walks up and gives them a treasure map or something and off they go. Well, superheroes are a little more like, you know, you're patrolling the city and you hear sirens or you hear gunshots or something.
Yep.
And then the question that Insomnia starts off with is, given that they're reactive instead of proactive, how do you think it best to hand out plot threads? It seems a bit silly when each game starts with the local authorities alert you to ...
So, well, part of it is that you learn to vary things over time, and you don't always start that way. You know, for the initial few games, as you know, the characters are establishing their reputations and, you know, getting their feet wet, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing to start with, you know, the bat signal flashes up in the sky or what have you, yeah. The red phone rings, and, you know, off you are to save the day. But, you know, eventually over time you build up a bit of a repertoire in terms of knowing who the characters are and what they want and what their, you know, various stories are, what's going on in their lives, and you can start with other plot points. You can pick up other threads and say, you know, okay, so, you know, this character, you know, who is searching for her missing father, you could start the adventure with, you have found a lead, mm-hmm. you know, to your father's whereabouts, and you are in the mountains of Tibet, you know, pursuing that lead, you know, what have you. And that's where you can start weaving those different threads into, you know, making them things where the characters are more proactive because they're mm-hmm. pursuing their particular goals, whatever they may be. And, you know, but that's the process of kind of getting things up to speed, to the point where the players have a better handle on, you know, what their characters are like and what their characters want and those sorts of things. And you can start playing around with different, story techniques. You know, I've done games of starting, you know, in the middle of scenarios or at the end of things and saying, you know, your character's in the midst of this, you know, crisis situation. Now let's go back, you know, a day and play the flashback scenario about how they got into this situation. Or I did one. In fact, I wrote a Marvel adventure that starts out with the heroes dealing with all of these strange crimes and incidences. And basically halfway through the adventure, they discover they're playing their own clones who are basically under the hypnotic control of the main villain. And the ones committing the crimes are them, and they're investigating themselves. The real heroes who have been kidnapped, basically we go to a cutscene where they wake up, you know, trapped in the villain's cloning lab and have to escape and confront the original clones who the players have been playing. So all of a sudden they have all this sympathy for the clones because they suddenly realize that these guys don't realize that they're not real. Mm-hmm. And they get to kind of experience that moment of wow, we're not who we think we are in the context of the adventure. So there are a lot of ways you can kind of mix it up. But there's also nothing wrong with starting, you know, the first few adventures with, you know, the crisis of the week and saying, hey, there's a problem and it's your job to fix it.
One of the things that – go ahead.
I was going to say I totally agree with that. I think the starting things off with sort of a monster of the week kind of approach definitely makes sense in the first few sessions because I kind of view that time as training the players, especially if it's a new group. If it's an older group, you don't have to do that quite so much, but you kind of have to train the players to pick up the plot threads that you're throwing in front of them and get them to understand that even though this is, well, this is at least my approach, even though this is a superhero game, I want you to be more proactive and I want you to suggest things and I want you to engage more fully than you would see characters like anybody in the comics actually does. Because you're not playing a comic, you're playing a role-playing game, and in theory you want to be interested in what your character is up to, what their life is like, you know, all that stuff, all that soap opera-y stuff that, you know, Spider-Man rarely wants something other than to defeat the villain. And, you know, if he does want something, it's usually, I've got a problem with a girl or, you know, whatever it is. He very rarely takes a more authority-ish type of view of things where he's like, you know, if I really want to get serious about this superhero thing, I'm going to do X. But I encourage my players to think that way for their characters in my game. Like, I think that can be some really interesting space to mess around in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, like John says too, the first few sessions are a lot of really throwing out plot threads and seeing which ones the players pick up. And introducing characters and, you know, having things, you know, situations come up and, you know, just seeing what happens. You know, I had a superhero scenario that pure happenstance in the course of the game, the characters were dealing with a hostage situation one of the victims got killed, and you know overall you know the heroes were seen as having you know done a pretty good job, but one of the heroes took it very hard that they had failed so badly, and you know that became a big plot element for that character of really like looking after this this woman's family. He ends up like adopting her son, it becomes a whole you know major plot thread for the character. And it was just some random thing that came up early on in the game.
Okay, let me jump on to the next one. Let's see. Here's a good question because a lot of players used to more you know games with a more fatal aspect to them where they're killing their villains more often. How do you handle recurring villains in a series? This person Insomnia says his players hate recurring villains over the course of like 5 to 6 games. The third time they saw the Battle Brothers, they were just, okay, how do we kill these people? So we never have to see them again.
That would tell me he's doing something right. I think it's all in how you approach that sort of thing, and mm-hmm. and really, you know, we talk about all this stuff and like whatever advice we've given out. I think we've told more stories than given advice, but hopefully they're good examples. But I always go to the source material, like watch the Avengers, watch. I mean the comic version. Watch the movie. What's the you just said it earlier, not the Teen Titans.
Young Justice. Called?
Young Justice, which I have not seen all of, but you know, check that stuff out because there is good storytelling in that, and mm-hmm. there's good sort of the weaving of the plot threads. I mean, some of it's a little melodramatic, obviously, because it's TV and it's got to be very punchy and quick. But, you know, read the comics, see how stories mm-hmm. are constructed that way. If I were going to suggest another game that you can play on a console, or I guess the PC, is the first Puzzle Quest. If you have not played that, I highly, highly recommend that in terms of how the story is strung together and how one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. It's really, really well done. And if you like Bejeweled, you'll be in heaven because that's all you do is play mm-hmm. Bejeweled. But it's the story aspect of it to me was really eye-opening. And then also, obviously, from the M&M product standpoint, the Game Master's Guide covers lots of different villains, their motivations, the types of mm-hmm. encounters, what I want to say, types of capers that they tend to...
Yep.
to
schemes.
Yes, schemes that they tend to be involved in. It doesn't go into tons and tons of detail on each one, but again, like Chris said earlier, there's only 7 plots, so if there's a little bit, you know, in these broad strokes that gets your head thinking, that's exactly, that's all you need. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Just go to the source material and go to the books that you think are good examples of how to come up with ideas and how to come up with something for your group. Because that's always what I go back to.
When I was a teenager.
I think I got this one. I'm sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
I think I got this one. Okay. Storytelling 101. Don't bring back an old villain until you absolutely cannot find any other way for the story that you want to tell to work without them.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Follow that simple rule. You're good.
Well, I think one of the things as far as addressing the recurring villains thing is, you know, bring them back often enough that the players will recognize them, but don't make them boring. You know, it's mm-hmm. and I think Christopher's got a good guideline there. For me, you know, like if I have a campaign villain that I'm planning to do something really big with, but I want to introduce him, you know, I'll throw him into a couple of capers here and there, but I'll kind of impress upon the players more his, you know, scheming nature, but I always kind of put him in a position where the players are not like giving him a kind of a moral strength that makes him too interesting for them to interact with, that they don't want to get rid of him. Like,
well, that's making, the trick.
Making, you know, like a Doctor Doom, I think, is often so much more interesting when the players go to him for help.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, it's like they know he's a bad guy. They know he's a megalomaniac, but he's the only one who can help them, you know, save Kitty Pryde,
right?
You know, or something like that. That suddenly makes him a fascinating character, and the situation becomes that much more interesting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the key to a recurring villain. You know, we talk a little about and Game Master's Guide about different roles villains can play. And one of the important stages of introducing a villain into the campaign as an ongoing character is connecting the villain with the characters in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fine to have recurring villains who are basically just recurring punching bags, but you don't want to overuse them or the players are just going to get bored.
Right.
Because they're tired of fighting these guys. They've seen their tricks. That's not all that interesting.
And also, if it's just about the combat, then they feel like they haven't accomplished anything because, oh, there
right,
they are again.
Because, right, the guys got out of jail again. you know, so a lot of the key to a recurring villain is to give the villain something, like you said, a hook that makes the villain interesting. Somebody that, to one degree or another, the players look forward to seeing that character again. And It can range from, you know, the fact that the villain has some kind of secret that everybody wants to figure out, to the, you know, the heroes or the players really just hate the villain that much, you know, but I mean, love to hate him, you know, not, you know, just like, oh, not this guy again, but, you know, just like, oh, I really want to take this guy down. you know,
or my favorite, make the villain sexy.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. It's like they always want to see the villain because, like, oh, that villain's hot. You know,
if
it's like there's this flirtation thing.
Catwoman scenario.
Yeah.
You know, the villain, yeah. That's great.
Yeah. And something else to put out there for food for thought. Don't ever set out to make a recurring villain, just set out to make a good villain.
The players,
if your players respond to it, then you can think about making them a recurring villain.
That's true. The players will decide which of your villains are recurring because it'll be the ones they like.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Actually, that is a process that I started a couple of years ago. I won't say how many years ago because that'll make Chris feel old again. But actually started asking my players, you know, kind of at the end of sessions, I would sit down with them and I'd have them go, well, what were the highlights of tonight's game for you guys? And I'd like write a little journal about their favorite characters, their favorite moments and things like that. And, you know, I kind of got them to score NPCs on how much they wanted to see the NPC come back for a future episode.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it would often surprise me which ones they wanted to see, because a lot of it, they weren't looking forward to seeing X villain again. They said, well, that was a cool villain, but, you know, I'm not really interested in seeing that again. But they might go, you know, that lady at the ramen shop was hilarious. We want to see her come back, you know?
Yeah, because, yep. I mean, not to be Mr. Pessimism, not to plant the seeds of doom, but frankly, is there anything sadder than a villain that the writer obviously wants to be a recurring villain and the readers or the players just aren't having
just
it?
Just aren't interested.
And the number one example I can think of is, remember Zero Hour when Extant was going to be the next big bad DC baddie?
Well, and that whole line really of, you know, Extant and Monarch and all the other would-be world beaters of that era.
You know, but he winds up controlling DC Comics for 4 months. He shows up one more time so Geoff Johns can kill him and get high fives from everybody in the comic world.
Yep. Well, sometimes it can be fun to be part of
that. I don't think there's
been
a more satisfying death since Jason Todd, frankly.
Oh. Yep.
John?
Yep.
Yes.
Wanted to jump in there? Did I miss something?
No,
never mind.
I did not say anything. Sorry.
Okay. So let's go on to the next question here. I think we tackled that one pretty well. Obviously, heroes have lives other than superheroes. And this is something that I can often fall into myself because I get so, you know, focused in on the superhero action and the storytelling. How much of a given adventure do you try and give time to the character, like their secret identity or their non-superhero actions?
Well, you know, in best Marvel tradition, I always opened up every single one of my, well, actually, regardless of what system I was running, I just said, well, is there anything in particular that you wanted your character to do during the downtime? And we would just do some ad-lib role-playing before the plot kicked in.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, those are some of the, I mean, these are the things that 20 years after the fact, my players come and tell me, oh, remember the time that happened? And it was just us just, you know, all right, throw something at me. Okay, you want to see, like you said, the woman at the ramen noodle shop again. Okay, just doing things like that. And, you know, and it really did help ground these characters. And it, every now and again, something would happen during that freeform role playing that, like, ooh, this is good. I'll have to remember to bring this back in a later plot line. You know, we could actually integrate this into the plot later on.
Right.
So I think really just giving your players the opportunity to kind of have some independence with their out of costume lives, you know, right off the bat, if you can swing it. I think that's certainly one of the more profitable things I ever did as Game Master.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think the setup scenes and adventures are a great opportunity to sort of start things off with, you know, the hero's sort of normal day-to-day lives before, you know, all the action starts kicking in, and just be like, you know, so, you know, it's the weekend. What is your character doing, you know, in his or her off time?
Yep.
You know, starting, you know, out with you know, just, you know, classic, you know, social scenes of, you know, so the adventure, when the adventure begins, it's poker night at your hero's headquarters.
Yeah.
And you guys are all sitting around the table playing, you know, and let's play out a hand. And, you know, how do your characters play poker? You know,
I will shamelessly say that because a lot of my comic book reading kind of kicked in right around the 80s. One of my favorite things to do in my role playing games was to do like the swimsuit issue or something where the characters were all like on vacation
day
together.
At the beach.
Yeah, to hit the beach or to, you know, to go to some exotic location, you know, like okay, well, you guys have just finished defeating, you know, the crazy minotaur that was menacing Greece, and you guys have a couple of hours to kill. What do you want to do? You know,
we should all sing Chris Claremont a check every time we do that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of my favorites was like, you know, he would kick off the New Mutants or something with the characters on the beach, you know, and then one of the characters would just pull a prank on the others, and then all of a sudden adventure would happen. But, you know, for me it was kind of like, you know, if as long as the players were having fun and I would throw them characters to interact with that they were entertained by, you know, I would have to brace myself to take that adventure that I had planned and, you know, the supervillain attack and maybe just save that for later and just see how long the players could entertain themselves and me along the way as just, you know, improv. And I think that you can actually, you know, get away with doing a whole adventure that way if your players are entertained and if that's enjoyable for everyone.
Absolutely.
So here's the evil question that he hits us with at the end, and this is something I'm going to have to think about because I've made a lot of big mistakes. But Insomni asks, what was everyone's worst mistake when it comes to making or planning an adventure? Because we always learn from something from other people's mistakes. Who wants to go first?
Well, you said evil. I think that defaults to John.
You know, I think we covered it a little bit, and I think it is the never assume your players are going to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And I still break that rule. Like you can't assume the players are going to behave the way your story that you have in mind tells them to, because they don't know it. Mm-hmm. They're always going to come up with something that screws over your plans, and that's a good thing, but then you got to kind of wing it a little bit. But yeah, it's often that I expect them to either take the reins on something or sit back and let it go without trying to interfere. And no, it always gets messed up.
Well, I'll tell you, my biggest one was way back when I was running Champions. You know, I was starting to get frustrated, and as new to the idea of point-based gameplay, I was getting frustrated with the way the players were constantly, you know, using what do we call them? Limitations on powers that weren't really that limiting. Just trying to point gouge so they could, you know, make their characters have all the powers that they wanted. And there wasn't really a mechanic for doing power stunts like there is in Mutants and Masterminds. I also the players had a tendency to be a little antisocial in their solutions to problems. So, you know, I just threw my hands in the air and I said, okay, we're going to make a game called Monster Squad or something. And this was not related to the movie, but it was basically, you guys could just, you know, I gave them like a ridiculous number of points and I said, make whatever you want and you guys can play whatever you want. And there's no, you know, you won't have to worry about getting in trouble with the law or anything if you do something bad. You guys can play bad guys if you want. And the players responded by making these really creative and kind of fun character concepts that were really a lot of fun for them to play. And they went around basically just harassing heroes. And the problem that happened was that they were having so much more fun than I was.
They called you bluff.
They did. I mean, they were having a blast. They were just, you know, basically deconstructing my carefully built setting and just kind of destroying it, you know, one hero at a time. And they were having a lot of fun, and I was kind of just getting frustrated because, like, all of my hard work is just not worth anything here because they just want to destroy everything. So that was the campaign that's like, you know, okay, what do we want to do this weekend? Everybody would say that, and I'm like, oh, again. But it was a very good learning experience for me because it made me realize just how much people, you know, want to cut loose. And it reminded me that, you know, my perception on the superhero genre isn't universal. But, you know, it was a problem. I don't know that in the end it balances out as a mistake, but, you know, it wasn't intentional. And it was probably one of my most popular campaigns with that old gaming group. And that was, you know, probably my biggest quote unquote mistake, I guess. Steve, do you have one?
I'm trying to pick just one.
Steve doesn't make mistakes.
If only. You know, I mean, a lot of it comes down to the sort of thing that John is talking about, that I think that my biggest mistakes as a game master have been, you know, that, you know, getting, you know, too attached to a particular way I wanted something to go. And, you know, finding out that you just can't gracefully force that to happen. And you just have to be willing to let go of that, you know, if it doesn't, you know, start to come together in terms of the game, you know. Otherwise, it's, you know, it's not really a matter, I don't know if it's really a matter of mistakes so much as just unexpected things. You know, that's just the way that some games and some adventures go. And you have these scenarios where it's like, okay, I didn't see that coming. Now I've got to figure out what happens next. And sometimes you recover from that more gracefully than others. I've had some games pretty well derailed by unexpected occurrences. I've had others that the unexpected occurrence worked out, you know, tremendously well. So, I was thinking of a particular instance. It's not a superhero game, but I had a Shadowrun game where the characters were doing this run, and they had basically been, you know, it's Shadowrun, so they'd basically been set up to take a fall.
The devil, you say.
Yeah, I know. Hard to imagine that. But the unexpected twist was when the characters got caught, basically, you know, in this, you know, this scenario where they were supposed to be set up, they turned themselves in.
Oh.
And I was like, crap. So I ended up, we took a break and I started the game again, and I said, okay, you've been in jail for a year now. And somebody comes to you and says, I want to make you an offer. And we did this
it'll end much better this time.
Right. We ended up doing this whole sort of Suicide Squad scenario where the characters basically got offered this, you know, this job that, you know, no, you know, sane Shadowrunner would take. And it was basically a get out of jail free card if they could pull it off. You know, and we had all sorts of fun, you know, playing out the implications of the characters having been out of circulation for a while, and now they were ex-cons, and, you know, all of this other stuff, you know. But it was totally, you know, and of course the whole second half of the scenario that I had planned, you know, went up in smoke, except of course for the fact that the characters were now incredibly motivated to find the guy who set them up.
sure.
So, you know,
that's a great one. I like that story.
Things don't go the way you plan, you know.
So, Christopher.
Okay, I was trying to narrow it down to two epic fails. I'm go with the two that have survived the culling so far. First of all, don't ever put too much on your player's ability to pick up on a callback element.
Probably
the absolute worst night of gaming that I am responsible for it being bad was, I was running a Star Trek adventure, and 2 months before they had gotten involved in Romulan espionage, and they were thwarted from and it was a pre-published adventure, and there's a thing about, like, well, they had this Romulan energy weapon deactivator. Like, the room goes all orange, and all of a sudden your phasers don't work anymore. Major plot point. Well, 2 months later, I was running a comedy adventure where they were taking down an Orion gangster syndicate. And I needed to come up with some way where they wouldn't just walk in, stun the guy, and have it be over with, because mm-hmm. I had all sorts of shenanigans and tomfoolery and hijinks that I wanted to do in between then. So they've got their takedown plan set up, and I put in, like, all of a sudden the room goes orange, and then going, like, well, I point my phaser at the guy and pull the trigger, and I say nothing happens. And I dealt with a riot for the next hour of, dude, why did my fucking phaser work? This is the worst fucking thing you've ever ran. Fuck you and fuck you, fuckity, fuck, fuck. I hate this adventure. And I actually did something I've never done before. Is this, I actually totally broke character and go, like, wait, didn't you get the orange light? And they're like, so what? And I'm like, you don't remember 2 months ago the orange light, the Romulans? They're like, no.
You did the Game Master equivalent of one of those little editor call asterisks that says, exactly, as referenced in this previous adventure.
Exactly. That's one where I wanted to take a bathroom break and sneak out the window.
I've had that situation happen to me as a player scenario, and it was kind of a little reverse thing where the GM had set up a setting, and he was introducing us to the setting, and basically it was the setting where we were all piloting kind of steam powered mecha, and he'd kind of described to us in cursory detail the major aspects of the technology, but forgot to mention a certain point that should have been really obvious to our player characters, but since the players didn't know about this aspect of the technology, we didn't pick up on the clue that something was unusual going on until later on, and then we got into this big heated argument about why our characters wouldn't have noticed this, you know? And it would have changed a lot of our decisions based on the fact, well, it's like, if these things only usually run for 30 minutes and we've been running for 4 hours, why didn't that raise any, you know, flags with our characters or something? So it was something that, you know, a communication issue, mm-hmm. and it's very easy for something like that to get blown out of proportion. So, it requires a little bit of humility on the part of the game master. You have to be willing to sit back and go, oops, okay, how do we fix this?
Because in my case, I was totally trapped because this had been set up as a comedy. Everything else I had on the rest of my paper was comedy. And I'm like, oh, my God, I've got 2 hours left, 2 hours of stuff left here, and ain't nobody laughing at nothing.
Nobody's in a laughing mood.
So my other big screw-up was don't be afraid to pull the plug on a campaign that isn't working. With two very, very, very blessed exceptions, I think every campaign I ever ran went about 2 months too long. You know, thankfully, I hope that I never got to the point where it got so bad that it kind of wiped out everything that was done before then. But you know, there were only two of them that I thought ended at the precise moment they needed to. And I just, looking back, I wish I'd been a little more prone to go, can we just not do this anymore?
Yeah. There's something to be said for leaving on a high note.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Definitely.
So let's see. I don't think John had a specific answer for that one. Let me go down to the next question. Let's see.
So actually, James, I will jump in.
Okay.
Because Christopher reminded me of something. His first example was don't rely on the character's ability to recall something, but also don't rely, or I should say the players, don't rely on the player's ability to pick up on a subtle hint.
Mm-hmm. Or even a not so subtle hint.
Or even not so subtle, but it's interesting. Because I try very much to build on what has happened before, even if it's, and I try to repeat things as I go, so that players, even if they're busy with something else or half distracted, they will pick up on it eventually. But yes, there have been some painful games where they're like, haven't we, like, should we know something about this? yeah, you've encountered this like the last six times, and you ask me this every time. Now, I haven't actually played with quite as much frequency as I did back when I was doing this often in games. So now iPhones and such would probably be my even a bigger nemesis than just the players themselves. But never try to be as obvious as possible without like giving away the farm in the first encounter. It's really difficult. I mean, it basically is the same as the sort of thing Christopher was saying, where, you know, don't rely on their ability to recognize a callback, but, you know, try not to be too
writers.
Subtle.
Yeah. Writers in TV shows and in movies have a, you know, kind of a guideline, a rule of three, where you want to introduce something and one of the things I try to do is encourage people to talk about plot points or things they think are plot points by going, you know, maybe rewarding them with a hero point or something, but, you know, in character and discuss them with the other players, because, you know, the more the players talk about something, or if they're role playing the investigation and asking the questions themselves, they're going to remember that a lot better than anything you just read off of a sheet of paper or something. Mm-hmm. Because when you participate in something, it becomes a part of the, you become part of the process. It's a lot more memorable. Cause you're imagining it a lot more clearly in your mind. Mm-hmm. I find that helps me a lot, is to try and involve the players as much as possible in the investigation, making them kind of drive it. And if they start asking questions that leads them in a direction away from, you know, my intended plot, sometimes I'll just change the plot. You know, I'll just go, well, wow, they came up with a really neat idea.
Much better idea, yeah.
And I'll just go, well, I'll just follow where they're going and try to set something up in front of them, you know, which is often a really fun way to play it, especially with mysteries. It's like, wow, they came up with something that was totally different from my intention. And, you know, I may actually, you know, I may lead them in a, you know, give them like a red herring or something to follow for a little bit. But, you know, if they're really invested in something, like if they make some really strong connections with NPCs and he's like, well, you know, I really want to help this girl because I really like her. And I'm like, well, I can make the big reveal that she is the villain, or I could change that, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, you kind of have this option where it's like, well, do I really want to break this guy's heart? Because he's like, can I have her as a campaign romance? And I'm like, ah. Oh. You know, she's the killer. It's like, maybe I should change that, you know. But there's you can see that in like movie pilots or TV pilots for shows, where you kind of see some of the setups and the characters change from like the very first pilot movie to the first episode.
Sure.
And so there's an alchemy that's going on with all the players that you should embrace and not sort of try to deal with it in a vacuum, you know. Let's see, going down the list here of questions I had. Actually, I was kind of segueing to this one myself. I was a little more curious about how best to handle transition scenes, how to better include the players in the experience, if you will, instead of just trying to make it seem like the game master is forcing them in a certain direction, which I think is kind of like, this can also connect to the previous request about handing out plot threads. So, aside from the things we've discussed so far, how do you try to involve your players in the game more, you know, get them more involved in the experience of the game? Steve, you got a good one on that one?
Well, you know, it depends on the type of transition you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you're talking about basically the, you know, transitions between major acts of the adventure, then, you know, it's really just, you know, providing enough information for the players to go on. You don't want to leave them completely hanging at the end of a scene with no idea about what they're supposed to do next. Mm-hmm. You know, unless you're really specifically trying to create, you know, a scenario where they have to wait around for something to happen. You know, so a lot of times it's, like you were saying earlier, a matter of focusing very heavily on the antagonist's plans and saying, okay, well, I know what the villain's next moves are. So I'm going to, you know, give the, you know, players enough information for them to follow up on different avenues of investigation or taking action, and see where that goes, you know, and how they cross paths again, you know. So if they are going to, you know, first look into the, you know, missing scientist, or if they're first going to look into the thefts that may be related to the, you know, potential power source for this gadget the villain wants to build, then, you know, those different paths can kind of converge in different ways. Or they need to go talk to this NPC or that, you know, other character.
A lot of the times the players are going to kind of volunteer ways that they can be involved. And as a mm-hmm. game master, you kind of have to watch for those opportunities and kind of yep. jump on them. You know, a lot of times game masters are worried about, like, having to counter all of these wonderful advantages that superheroes have. But, you know, it often helps you out to look at them as opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Like, for example, your Batman character may say, well, I want to use my connections to get to this, to investigate this. And you're like, well, I already had all these other characters that you would be able to talk to and get the information you need. But he's going to go across town and talk to a snitch who has nothing to do with this story. And mm-hmm. you have the option there of basically going, well, that's a dead end, and not giving them any information. Or you have the opportunity there to go, well, how could I connect the snitch to the story?
Right. Yeah. And, I mean, you have ahead. To, as game master, you have to say no to the players often enough as it is mm-hmm. that, you know, if whenever you can say yes to them, you try to, mm-hmm. even if it's just yes, but, you know, something, but yeah, I mean, especially if it's something that you can make happen, you know, that isn't going to, you know, mess up your adventure, then yeah, by all means, if the player's got a thing, they want to do their thing, whatever their thing is, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, talk to their criminal contacts or, you know, go, you know, into a trance and investigate the secrets of the astral realm, you know, if it's that's their character's thing, then yeah, by all means, let them do it. And, you know, make it part of the, you know, transition or part of the investigation in some way.
Okay. Let's see. And I think you actually kind of covered this, but Nathan, my editor, specifically threw this one out for Steve. How many adventures have you pulled out of the Earth's Mightiest Heroes? You've been doing the blog where you talk about how to kind of treat some of the scenes from the cartoon in gameplay mechanics.
Yeah.
How many adventures have come out of that for you?
Surprisingly few, actually. Well, partly because everyone in my game group, you know, watches the show, and I try to, as much as possible, not completely obviously rip off, you know, major comic book or animated show plots, you know, beyond, you know, really, you know, archetypal level stuff. You know, not a tremendous amount in that regard. Certainly, you know, there have been some ideas in terms of how to frame adventures and how to handle certain elements of them, but I haven't really lifted a whole lot from the show in terms of wholesale plots. That's actually been one of my other, you know, hard learned lessons as a game master, is if you're going to steal, and you are, I mean, as a game master in terms of plot ideas, at least, you know, try and, you know, hide your tracks as much as you can. Because there's nothing worse than, you know, being 10 minutes into the start of your adventure and having, you know, somebody be like, oh, this is the plot of Batman 116. you know, and being like, oh, crap, it is. you know, because you can put yourself in the situation where the, you know, the players already know everything that's going to happen because you've copied things too, you know, close to the original.
But, you know, just to follow up on something I was saying earlier, that's where I think it's important if you're devouring other types of media. You mm-hmm. know, you're not just pulling in all your ideas from comics or
sure.
or something like that. You know, I mean, I describe Time of Vengeance as a combination between Citizen Kane and the abominable Dr. Fibes. You know, so right there. And the real secret of it started out as an homage to Steve Gerber.
Yeah.
And the weird stuff that he was – distinctive stuff he was doing in comics. And then – so it's a little bit this iconoclastic comic book writer, and it's coming from two classic movies that don't immediately scream comic book at you. So I think the more diverse elements that you can pull from – you know, I mean, I probably shouldn't admit this. I've done adventures I got from pop songs. You know, wherever you're pulling your influences from, the wider that they range from – I think the less likely are that people are going to sit there and go, oh, that's Avengers 16.
Right. I mean, and the less, you know, specific they are, you mm-hmm. know, I've been able to do, you know, and this is sort of an Avengers example of, you know, I've been able to do, adventures of time traveling villain from the future, you know, shows up to conquer the past, you know, which is a classic Avengers plot. But, you know, beyond that hook, it doesn't bear any particular resemblance to the plot of an Avengers story. In fact, I did a scenario that was actually time-traveling villain from the future has already conquered the past, and you have to figure out how to undo it as an adventure.
Right, right.
You know,
I think one of the things that I tended to do in my youth, I don't necessarily do it as much now because I'm just so much more awesome than I was then. No, I'm just kidding. I just had this tendency to kind of take a character from a movie that inspired me in some way or fascinated me, mm-hmm. and kind of bridge them into the setting somehow, or do like a fan fiction-y kind of continuation of that story in order to create a character. Like, I remember one of the character storylines that I did for an old Champions game was really just a riff on the movie Scanners. You know, the idea behind Scanners was this, it's this kind of R-rated, you know, gory science fiction approach to telepathy. And these special people were created by a drug test gone wrong, and they had these telepathic powers which allowed them to make people's heads explode. And, you know, while shocking and gory, what fascinated me about it was, okay, there's this setup here for a fantastic follow-up story. And I just kind of decided, well, I'd follow up on the idea of what would happen in my gaming setting if something from the 70s came back to haunt people in modern day, and had like a character who is kind of the son of a character from the movie, you know, as far as that story went, and just kind of mm-hmm. took it in a new direction, but made it fit the setting. But it was just, you know, I was totally letting myself be inspired by that, just totally stealing that idea. And it's okay to do that as long as, you know, what you're relying on for inspiration doesn't necessarily offer the players an easy solution to the problem. Like, mm-hmm. like, you know, you wouldn't say, oh, this is the plot to Avengers 16. It's like, you know, oh, well, I know where he's getting this from, but that doesn't tell me how to fix the problem.
How to fix it, right.
Yeah.
If anything, it just tells me how bad the situation really
is. Exactly. So that's kind of fun. Let's see. Tim Brown just threw this one in here off of Facebook. He says, out of general principle and my love for Freedom City, any word on that front would be cool. So what do we guys have coming up for Freedom City, or what's your favorite way to introduce people to Freedom City?
Next month, Freedom City hardcover. No, I totally lied.
You're going to get me in trouble, man.
You heard it here first on the Vigilance Press podcast.
That's right.
He's lying. In case you guys didn't hear that, he's lying. Go ahead.
Oh, well, just, you know, best way to introduce Freedom City, blow it up. Yeah, put it back effective. Together by the end. Put it together by the end, of course.
But, we're done.
And am I allowed to say that I'm updating some classic Freedom City material right now?
You are.
Good. Okay. It's not going away. It is at least a part of it is coming back.
Oh no. Yeah, yeah. No. The Freedom City stuff is definitely still alive and well, and people will definitely see something. It certainly won't be this year.
Yeah. Yeah. Although the great thing about the Emerald City setting is that people will see a lot of there's a lot of the spirit of Freedom City in that. Mm-hmm. People will see a lot of elements that will connect the two, and you know, will show off the fact that they exist in the same world. Mm-hmm. So I was looking over some of the Emerald City stuff earlier today, and you know, was like, wow, you know, this really is, you know, it makes me nostalgic for a lot of our Freedom City material. So I think people will find a lot of nice resonance there as well.
What's it like? I mean, I've created my own settings before, usually collecting material from published material and then, you know, doing my own stuff, you know, where I had time to build my own stuff. But sometimes, you know, you've put a lot of effort and work into Freedom City. What's it like seeing what other people do with it? I mean, how much attention do you pay?
That's my favorite part.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. What people do with it is to me the most interesting part about Freedom City. I mean, you know, I'm very glad for you know, having put it all together, and you know, it was definitely a labor of love, but. You know, the thing to me about Freedom City that's the most interesting is the way people take it and make it their own and bring it to life. Because I really just presented a sort of, you know, snapshot of, you know, here's what, you know, this setting is like, you know, as a big overview. But, you know, it's really when people take it and do something with it that it really comes to life and things start happening. And, you know, so I love to hear about stuff where people are just like, oh yeah, and I you know, killed off this character and I changed this thing and, you know, oh, this team is totally different. And, you know, that stuff's great. I love that stuff. Mm. You know,
I'll tell you a creative secret, James.
Yes.
The reason Time of Crisis came from two places: my love of Julie Schwartz, and secondly, not wanting to mess up what Steve had created. Ironically, blowing up the universe was my way of being able to tell a story and not mess up anything that Steve had done. And this is before I realized that, you know, the more that you kind of, you know, do cool things with his toys, the happier he is. But at the time, it's like I don't want to steal like your Chewbacca, man. You know, I just wanted to be so respectful of what he had done. I figure if I just blow everything up and mess up these parallel worlds, then, you know, that would at worst be like, you know, kind of me doing some graffiti in the margins. You know, it wouldn't mess up the original source material all that much. And, you know, but, you know, so it came from a fearful place, but I'm glad it turned out as well as it did. And then, you know, later on I learned how truly, truly awesome Steve is. And the answer to that is, of course, very awesome. But yeah, that's kind of was part of the genesis of the project there, was not wanting to mess up the setting too bad, so I blew it up.
What I like about the Freedom City setting for myself is there are so many toy boxes and corners, you know, and this is a big sandbox to go play in, and you do have the option to kind of, you know, focus on aspects that you want to. Like for my Beacon City game, and I'll be borrowing elements from Freedom City for the podcast. You'll see some characters pop in there at some point. I'll probably be using Aegis, but my own flavor of Aegis, you know, and.
Sure.
And that's the fun part, is that you know, I think about gaming in a setting where everybody has their own spin on it, but there are certain elements that are community, almost not quite community property, but you get the idea that they all have, everybody has their own associations with the characters, but they're familiar. Like everybody knows that, you know, who's been in a Freedom City campaign. Everybody knows Omega is pretty much a badass, you know? And so
right.
anybody who says we took down Omega, you know, you sit down and go, well, how did you do that? You know? And, it becomes something, a shared experience that people can talk about. And that's the fun part for me. And that's one of the things I really like about adventures is if, you know, in a published setting, you know, if you're going to use published material, you get this connection to other people's games that you wouldn't otherwise have. It's like, well, my GM created this character that was really awesome. And you're like, well, that sounds really awesome, but I don't know how that would work, you know, how my character would work in that setting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you talk about something that everybody has experienced, like, you know, in Champions, it was Dr. Destroyer, you know.
Right.
And, and you had the island of Dr. Destroyer or something. I can't remember the specific name of the adventure that came with the Game Master screen.
Yeah,
but
that's the one.
It was a fairly straightforward series of encounters with his minions that led up to a big throwdown with the character.
It was a big superhero dungeon.
Yeah. and you know, yet it was something that kind of came with the kit. You know, you all sat down and played it, and everybody had their own take on it. So it was something that everybody would have this experience with. And that's what I like about adventures, is being able to share those experiences and talk about them. But as we've said before, I think one of the big things about adventures are the unexpected moments. And those are the ones that I remember the most, like years later. Like the moment where the quiet guy at the table stood up and like did a rousing speech, and like everybody's eyes just popped out of their heads, you know, the moment where somebody does something out of character and unexpected but wonderful, and and those you can't plan for, and you shouldn't. You should just kind of create the environment to let them happen. And hope they do. I mean, not every game is going to be a winner, but you know, at least as long as you're having fun and you don't make enemies
or cause a riot,
I think you're doing it right. Yeah. But I think that's pretty much a good note to kind of end on. I hope we covered everybody's questions. If anybody has any more questions, feel free to comment on the podcast. Did anybody want to have any closing remarks they wanted to give before we sign off?
I think that's a pretty good note to end on.
Yeah, you have great endurance if you have listened for this long.
All right, Christopher, John, Steve, it was wonderful having you guys on. I always like to bring you guys on. And, we still can't talk about October yet, right?
We can't.
Okay.
We will.
Okay. They keep asking, so I have to keep asking. But thanks again for stopping by. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, if you have any other topics you want us to cover in a future podcast related to this, I can always bring on some of our other guests as well, so I don't keep taking Steve away from writing more power profiles, which which I'm really looking forward to some of the next ones, by the way.
Me too.
But anyway, thanks again for stopping by, guys. Thanks again for the Freedom City campaign and all of the wonderful things you've created that you now let us play with. So thanks again, and to everyone listening, stay vigilant.